Good morning. I am Mari Allen, volunteer interviewer with the Mill Valley Public Library, doing an oral history of Catherine Shaw on Friday, October 28th, 2016 at 10 a.m. And if Catherine, if you can introduce yourself.
Okay, I'm Catherine Shaw, and I live in Mill Valley.
Very good. Thank you. So let's begin. So tell me first about yourself, where you were born, and then also about your husband, who's you're going to be speaking about as well.
Okay. My name's Catherine Shaw. I was born in Louisville, Kentucky in 1943, in the same hospital where my mother had been born almost 26 years before. Mm-hmm. My father was in the Air Force, so we moved around a good deal. I came to Mill Valley in 1975 when I was pregnant with our second child. Professionally, when I was young, I worked as a draftsman in engineering offices. I drew, among other things, the underground plans for the San Francisco International Airport. When our older child went into seventh grade, it was a biology class, and biology was one of my many undergraduate majors. And after the teacher explained what the class was going to be, it just sounded wonderful. In fact, interestingly, it was very much the same as my mother's college-level zoology class in the 1930s. That's how things have changed from the 30s to the 80s. So afterwards, I said, this sounds like a really good class, but it sounds very labor-intensive. I'll volunteer some help. And she said, oh, wonderful, just another pair of hands. I said, I do have a background in biology. She said, oh, so good. My degree is in 18th century literature. So she actually referred to me as her teacher while I was officially her teacher's aide.
Oh, wow.
And from that, I got into teaching ESL, both at the Mill Valley Middle School and at TAM. When the children were grown, I went back to school and finished my master's in Buddhist studies at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley.
And what year was that?
Finished in 2000. Mm-hmm. So I was 50 when I started. Mm-hmm. And worked for a while as the manager of the Buddhist bookstore, which is at the Buddhist Churches of America, or was at the time at the Buddhist Churches of America headquarters on Pan and Octavia in San Francisco. In 2003, my father, who had been caring for my mother for quite a few years, got very sick himself. Mm-hmm. And I went to Bellingham, where they lived, and for the next 8.5 years was more there than here taking care of them.
In Bellingham, Washington.
Bellingham, Washington, mm-hmm. Yes, very good. Many people know.
Mm-hmm. So, Catherine, let me backtrack a little bit. Mm-hmm. So you were born in Kentucky. Did you go to high school?
In Bellingham, Washington.
Okay, so
my parents moved there when I was 14. I went to what was then called junior high school mm-hmm. in San Diego, California. Mm-hmm. When my father finished his PhD in psychology, he resigned his commission in the Air Force, went to work as a civilian for the Navy doing the same work, which was testing recruits to see where to put them. Mm-hmm. And finally, after trying for years, got an academic position as associate professor at Western Washington University in Bellingham. So that's why we were there.
And so you graduated from high school?
No, I did not.
Oh, you didn't? Oh, so continue telling me your story. We need to go way back.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm born in February, mm-hmm. which means that I started elementary school at 6.5 instead mm-hmm. of 6, which was heartbreaking to my parents, who grew up in the age when you skip grades if you were smart, and they just couldn't believe it that I couldn't start at 5.5. Mm-hmm. And finally, by the end of the whole thing, they realized if I could get accepted into college, I wouldn't have to finish high school.
Wow.
So I only went, in those days, it was 3 years of junior high and 3 years of high school, so mm-hmm. I only went to 2 years of the high school, and then was accepted at Reed College in Portland, and so went off to there at 17.5 instead of 18.5.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, I didn't graduate. When I realized I wasn't going to finish Reed, I took the GED test, so I do have a high school diploma, which I needed to get a BA and an MA, of course.
And your master's is also from Reed? Or
no, it's from the Institute of Buddhist Studies, part of the graduate
program. Okay, so that, so you did, so you were talking about being a draftsman.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
What was your undergraduate degree in then?
Well, I went five different times. The draftsman came from architecture. That was the only one that actually led to anything. Mm-hmm. Thrice in biology, twice in art, once in architecture. Finally graduated in humanities from New College of California in San Francisco, which no longer exists.
Mm-hmm.
So, very checkered academic career. For coming from a family of devoted academics, I was a bit of a black sheep.
And how many siblings do you have?
None.
None. Okay. And so... Mm-hmm. When you graduated from Reed College and then, or left Reed College.
Yes, after 1 year.
And then you arrived in San Francisco in 1975, you said?
In Mill Valley.
Oh, okay. When did you get to?
Okay, let's see. Well, pretty much immediately. Most of my adult life has been in the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm.
Met my husband at Reed.
So you met. So tell me a little bit about Larry, too.
Okay, here we go. This is the more interesting story.
Oh, no, not at all.
Okay. He was born in Washington, D.C. because his parents were there because his father worked for the Department of Agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
When he was a year and a half, they came to the Bay Area, and his father worked in Albany. They lived in Albany till he was 10.
What is Larry's birth date?
August 12th, 1939.
Mm-hmm.
He graduated from Reed. So I guess he went to Pleasant Hill High School, graduated mm-hmm. from Reed in physics, went to work at Lawrence Livermore, where he had been working in the summers. And he did well enough as a summer intern there that they started hiring other summer interns, mm-hmm. and then afterward went to work there as a junior physicist, and realized how good his Reed education was when his lab technician also had a degree in physics from Fresno State.
Mm.
And was accurate who should be the physicist and who should be the technician. He worked there for a few years. We got married in 1963.
And where you met at Reed, you said?
We met at Reed. Mm-hmm. That my freshman year was his senior year.
Oh, okay.
And after a year at Reed, I went briefly to the art school in Portland and then hitchhiked around.
Mm-hmm.
And at one time found myself and a friend stranded in Tracy. So we added up our money and found we had enough to take the bus to Livermore.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I know someone who lives in Livermore. So we arrived in Livermore. Larry Shaw found in the phone book, went to an address, left our stuff there, went out. I guess we had enough more money to get something to eat, came mm-hmm. back, and here was a total stranger. There were two Larry Shaws in Livermore.
Oh, my gosh.
And they both worked at the lab, so this one knew the other one. Put us in his car and drove us out to the, by that time it was rather late, and the second Larry Shaw got out of bed to greet us and brought
Catherine.
And
what was your maiden name?
Adams.
So you were Catherine Adams when you met Larry Shaw number two at his place in Livermore.
Right. Which was easy bicycling distance to the lab.
Mm-hmm.
So soon after he took us into San Francisco, where excuse me, I may need water.
Mm-hmm.
Where we were going, all right, I will take the bottled water.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Okay, thank you very much. And we saw, excuse me, we saw each other off and on mm-hmm. thereafter. Let's see, what year would that have been? I guess 61 about, mm-hmm. and then we were married in 63.
Where were you married?
On the slopes of Mount Diablo, we started one of the starts of the pagan community
mm.
in the Bay Area. And one of the things I brought was a photo album of one of our re-weddings. We decided we should get mm. married every 7 years, since it's known that the body has pretty much become new every 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't want to be living in sin. Mm-hmm. So a poet and scholar wrote the wedding ceremony.
Mm-hmm. And what was the date of that?
The full moon in June of 1963. 63 mm-hmm. when I was 20, mm-hmm. and he was almost 24. I don't remember the monthly date because everyone after was simply the full moon in June every anniversary mm-hmm. and varied from year to year what mm-hmm. the monthly date was. At that time, he was working at Livermore, and he retired mm-hmm. at age 64, and we and our cat drove up the Oregon coast and eventually ran totally out of money while waiting for his retirement check. And it was raining the whole time. The cat was very, sometimes we slept in the car because it was just too rainy to do anything else. The cat would go out in the evening and come back dry in the morning somehow.
Oh, my gosh. And you said you have children.
Yes, we have two children born in 1972 and 1975.
And what are their names?
Tara and Sarah.
And where are they now?
Tara is in Berkeley. She is a Kaiser physician, mm-hmm. sports medicine. For a while, she was the only sports medicine physician in all of the Oakland Kaiser. Mm-hmm. Now they've hired another. Mm-hmm. Sarah is in Spokane. She's a veterinarian.
Mm-hmm. And what high school did they go to?
Well, they both went to TAM to start with. Mm-hmm. Sarah is a very independent soul and couldn't stand the regimentation. She lasted one semester mm-hmm. and went to San Andreas, mm-hmm. which at the time was quite a good school. Since then, it's been combined with what they call the continuation school, so I understand it isn't as good as it was. But at the time, those were two very different things. Mm-hmm. The independent study school.
It has become Temescal, which is where my oldest daughter goes.
Oh, so it must still be good then.
So San Andreas is one, but Temescal is the independent study school. That's what spun off.
Oh, how
interesting. So it still exists.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. I'm so glad. Yeah. The teachers were really, really good. And they encouraged her to take the California high school equivalent test mm-hmm. at age 16, which mm-hmm. she did. It supposedly is equivalent to passing in the upper half of your class. She said it was very, very easy. She didn't impress her with what the upper half of high school might be. Yes, so she graduated from there. Tara was valedictorian at TAM. She mm-hmm. does very well in well-structured mm-hmm. environments.
And remind me again, who is the elder one?
The elder one is Tara, the one who likes structure.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
Yeah. Although she married a woman who likes structure even better than she does. Which became evident when they had children. Tara bore the children, mm-hmm. Who were twins, and so took a lot of care. Mm-hmm. And the grandparents would come when we would walk around a lot to put them to sleep. And when it was Tara and Larry and I, we would kind of drift across mm-hmm. the streets. And when it was Sarah, her spouse is also the same name as her sister, mm-hmm. Different spelling, and Larry and I, we would go to each corner exactly, turn exactly, mm-hmm. cross on the crosswalk, go to the next corner exactly.
How old are your grandchildren?
Seven.
Okay.
They are now in second grade, first year they've been separated.
Okay. And where are they in school?
Malcolm X, Martin Luther King is a community, mm-hmm. is a junior high, middle school, Malcolm X Elementary. Very good school.
In what?
In Berkeley.
In Berkeley. Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's go back to you and Larry. Okay. So when did he get involved working with the Exploratorium?
Okay. What year? It was shortly after it started. Of course. It was 1972. Mm-hmm. And a good friend that we had lived with down the peninsula had somehow found out about it and was head of electronics and hired Larry to be the second person in electronics. 1972, he worked there until 2005. It's a long time. And during that time, he did just about everything that there is to do there. At first, of course, the staff was very small and everybody did mm-hmm. everything. But as it went along, electronics hired more people and there got to be more departments. One of the more interesting sub-careers within that was they have a program called Artists in Residence. Mm-hmm. And various artists will come and create something. And he was the technical help for the artist, which was some very interesting things. It also led us to having free admission at every avant-garde thing in the city for a number of years, which was quite delightful.
And one thing that students in Mill Valley know about, so every year now at Mill Valley Middle School, they celebrate something on March 14th, 314. That is known as Pi Day, and all the students bring a pie of some sort. And when you Google that, Pi Day, the first name that pops up is Larry Shaw.
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about that? Because when I tell students that the inventor of Pi Day resides in Mill Valley, they are just shocked. So tell me about that very innovative idea.
Okay. When Frank Oppenheimer, the founder, died, there was an interregnum which was somewhat difficult, and the next director was not a good fit. He was a good person, but not a good fit. So they were having difficulties. In fact, during that period, we happened to be in London, and at the Natural History Museum there, they asked us all about it, and we knew nothing, and they kept assuming that we were simply hiding the truth. And later we learned that many small independent museums die under those circumstances, and that was what was expected of the Exploratorium.
Mm-hmm.
So they went to they had an employees retreat, staff retreat at Assiniboia for a day or two, and during the course of that, Larry came up with the idea of Pi Day as something to unify the staff and developed a Pi Shrine, which I have with me.
What was it? What is it called?
This is the Pi Shrine.
A Pi Shrine.
Yes, there it is.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. Well, afterwards, I'll take a photograph of it.
Yes, the new Exploratorium has a new Pi Shrine.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a ceremony leaving the old Pi Shrine of taking this one up.
Mm-hmm.
In the old Exploratorium, there was a circular building in the center, which was a classroom, and then upstairs was exhibits. So in the center of the circle of the circular building, they installed the circular Pi Shrine with some ceremony. And then every year at March 14th at 1:59 in the afternoon, we would have a little Pi Parade, which Larry led. I have some pictures of that. And circumambulate the Pi Shrine 3 1/7 times, of course. And then eventually it was discovered that was also Einstein's birthday.
Oh.
Our younger daughter was doing a paper on him and said, "Dad, did you know Einstein was born on Pi Day?" So then we would sing happy birthday to him.
Mm-hmm.
The first few years it was just staff. In fact, the first year of all, it was on a Monday when the museum is closed. So we thought eating pie would be appropriate, and we got coffee and tea and cream and plates and pie, and the staff, we got together and had a little celebration.
And let me clarify for the transcriber that the pie that we're discussing for Pi Day is P-I, Pi Day, 3.14, on and on and on. And the pie that we're talking about that was brought in is P-I-E, pie, that is eaten.
Which is usually round and therefore appropriate. And we've had other round things as well. Pi, Larry refers to it as the interdimensional rotator. It changes one dimension into two by its relationship between the diameter and circumference of the circle. It also has many other applications, it turns out, and as you pointed out, goes on forever.
Mm-hmm.
It never repeats. It is far more random than the best random number generator ever invented. There's little games of finding one's birthday in it and things like that, which you can. Any sequence of numbers that can exist somewhere, most likely, is in Pi. It's been now worked out to, I have no idea how many places, but far more than are necessary to measure the circumference of the universe to millimeters.
Wow. And then I had read that Pi Day was begun in 1988. And then I also read that in 2009, the United States House of Representatives recognized Pi Day. I wrote down the date. I think it's March of it was probably 314 of March 14, 2009. Pi Day was given an official recognition by the U.S. House of Representatives.
Yes, this is true. And it's also celebrated internationally. Now, many places in the world, of course, do not date things as we do, month, day, year, but rather do day, month, year. So they have to have Pi approximation day on June 22nd, 622. Mm-hmm. No, March 22nd, 322, Yeah, 322. But still, 314, having been the original one, is pretty much the official Pi day, even where it doesn't quite match. And so after a few years of it being just staff, it did occur, of course, on a day when the museum was open and what publics chanced by were told about it and invited in to eat pie. Eventually, marketing department came to exist and found out about it, and it got more widely spread, and they even got Marie Callender and Safeway to donate pies, and we started having lectures and events in the McBean, the old theater in the old museum, and then the pie parade with a boom box with the digits of pi to pomp and circumstance going up the stairs and around. So it got bigger and bigger. And as you say, now it's celebrated everywhere, not just at the Exploratorium. In fact, many people are unaware that it started at the Exploratorium.
Exactly. So I have tried to spread that news, especially through Mill Valley Middle School. It's something to take great pride in, that it began with an idea from someone from this town. Mm-hmm. You can tell Larry. He would be excited to know that they have a contest to see who can remember the most digits out. So I think I'm not quite sure, but I think it's held by a girl. Mm. 2 years ago, she went more than 200 digits. Hugely. It's a coveted prize.
Yes. Often high schools will come with various things. One brought a song 1 year that they had made up. And Ron Hipschman, who was Larry's partner at the Exploratorium and with whom we still have lunch once a week, has gotten very involved in Pi Day. Mm-hmm. And he has a favorite pizzeria, so they now come and demonstrate pizza pie making, including to learn how to throw pizza dough. There's a rubber thing like pizza dough that you learn how to throw, so they bring that along. And they also usually bring some real pizza dough. It gets a little messy.
Well, that's great fun. Yes. Well, tell me more about your time in Mill Valley. So the Oral History Project, we really want to know about what Mill Valley was like when you got here, what you've seen over the years, and what you think about
what's happening
now. I've
actually given some thought
now.
To that.
Yeah.
We came in 1975. We paid $30,000 for our house, which was double what it would have been a few years before. And, of course, now it's worth orders of magnitude. Well, it's still not worth huge. It's still a small little cabin. But still, who knows? The thing that impresses me most as far as changes goes is the automobiles. Yes, there are more of them. But more importantly, when we came, no one that lived up in the hills as we do drove a large car, period. It simply does not make sense. There were rich people then who had very expensive small cars, but no one would think of driving a large car on those roads. Everyone drove small cars. Mm-hmm. When the SUV, which I say stands for silly, useless vehicle, craze started, I at first thought it was a joke. I couldn't believe anyone would want one of those things. Now, most of our neighbors drive them. And getting around has gotten very, very difficult. That's the biggest change, in my opinion. There have, of course, been lots of others, that it's gone from being a small artist hippie town to being a rich people's town, which makes sense. You know, we're half an hour from the city. I'm surprised that it took rich people that long to discover us. But that, to me, is not as big a change as the cars.
And you and Larry walk a lot in our town. And you know a lot of people who've been here as long as you have. And what do you think, what are their thoughts on the changes that you've seen, do you think?
Well, they're disturbed by the big houses. One person commented that every big house doesn't just bring the two cars for the two adults and possibly two more if they have two teenagers, but also all the vehicles for all the service people, the pool person, the dog walker, the nanny, the housekeeper, all have to bring their cars. And our roads should not be any bigger. If they were any bigger, it would harm the hillsides. So I think that's a major thing, and I think almost everybody I know would agree. We have one neighbor, Joyce Britt, who has been very, very involved in town politics and trying to prevent destruction of the environment. Around the year 2000, she and I and some others mounted a major campaign to try and get more public open space, particularly in the Redwoods. Most of the open space we have now is on the other side of the valley where it's clear. We pretty much failed. It became obvious that it was already decided and nothing we could do would change it. But we filled the city council chambers with huge numbers of standing room only people and gave well-reasoned, impassioned speeches and so on with too little effect. After which I decided I wasn't going to be involved in local politics anymore. She, who was an extremely successful trial lawyer, has continued to throw herself against it for years and years and has had some small success, but nothing like what one would expect for a person of her accomplishments. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
Oh, no. I want you now, if you wouldn't mind, telling me about your, so you have your master's in Buddhist studies. So, And I've read that you're involved in the Marin Interfaith Council, if that's correct,
yes.
And the Buddhist Temple of Marin.
That's true.
And so my mom is Japanese. Uh-huh. So when she first came to visit, she was fascinated that there is a Buddhist temple mm-hmm. in our little town.
And a Japanese-oriented Buddhist temple.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Did she come?
She hasn't. The schedule has not made it possible.
Mm-hmm. But I sometimes speak there.
Can you tell me about that
my
part of your life?
Our life involvement
yeah.
with that. We've been Buddhists our whole adult lives. We weren't involved in Japanese Buddhism before mm-hmm. joining this temple because it's in our town.
So did you become Buddhist together, or were you Buddhist before you met Larry?
Okay. Well, when I was in high school, I thought it'd be nice to have a religion. My parents are committed atheists. They really, my father has said, my God is still reason. They committed to that way of looking at the world. Mm-hmm. But I've always been fascinated by religion. The Life, when I was a child, Life magazine had a big series on the world religions with pictures of all the different mm-hmm. stuff. And my grandparents on both sides are fundamentalist Christians, so it was a bit of an issue in the mm-hmm. household. So in high school, I studied them all carefully and determined that Buddhism made the most sense. And so I have often told people it was 10 years between when I decided I was a Buddhist and when I met another one. Mm-hmm. Which isn't 100% true, but mm-hmm. it's close. But it was all in books for many years. And when Larry and I got together, he also had a similar feeling. Mm-hmm. When would that have been? In the late 70s, many Tibetan Buddhist teachers started teaching in the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, not the late 70s, the early 70s. And we became involved. And in 74, Naropa Institute, which is a Buddhist university, which is now accredited, it's a graduate school only, opened in Colorado. Boulder, Colorado. Our daughter was 1.5.
Mm-hmm.
Her name was Tara, who is the embodiment of compassion and mercy. Good for a doctor.
Mm-hmm. And does she have a middle name?
Ananda.
Mm-hmm.
And Liz.
Oh.
Also the name of Shakyamuni Buddha's cousin and lifelong attendant. A man.
Mm-hmm.
Ah is a masculine ending in mm-hmm. Indic languages. So we went to Naropa Institute for their very first session in the summer. That was her first preschool.
Mm-hmm.
Enough of the little girls there were named Tara that if the attendants couldn't remember a little girl's name, they'd say Tara and had a good chance to be right. it's a popular name. Yeah. Interestingly, in Sanskrit, there's no differentiation between T and D, so it's really Tara, halfway mm-hmm. between mm-hmm. the two. So I joke that she can't pronounce her own name. But in this country, it's Tara. In some mm-hmm. countries, it's Dara mm-hmm. that throws the other one. Mm-hmm. But here, it's Tara. Everyone says mm-hmm. Tara. Mm-hmm. she loved it. We mm-hmm. loved it.
And how long? Did you just stay for the summer?
Just for the summer, mm-hmm. yeah. And then toured around a bit and came back and bought our house in Mill Valley in 1975, had our second child.
And where did the girls go to elementary school?
In Old Mill.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yep, right near the library.
Yeah, they both went to Old Mill. They both went to Mill Valley Middle School, mm-hmm. where, as I said, I've worked as a teacher's aide teaching ESL mm-hmm. and biology mm-hmm. and a few other things. Okay.
And when did you get involved with the Buddhist temple?
Right, right. We were aware of its existence.
So it existed before?
Oh, yes. Okay. It's been there a long time. In fact, we paid off the mortgage shortly after we joined in 85. It started in people's homes. Mm-hmm. One of the good people who's there now, Junko Nakagawa, is the daughter of one of the founders, although one could even say the founder because her father was so involved. And it went around in people's homes.
And what was her father's name?
I'm afraid I don't know his first name.
Oh, okay, Nakagawa. But Nakagawa. Okay.
He died shortly after we joined. Mm-hmm. I do remember him. And a tribute to the welcoming of the community, we were the first Caucasians in the Sangha, that's Buddhist for community. And I was unaware of that until somebody mentioned it to me years later. Just the fact that we were the first hippies, I was aware of that. That was, mm-hmm. you know, a bit concerning. But that we were the first Caucasians, I really did not notice. Mm-hmm. And that sounds absurd, but it's true. So we in 84, my parents, who were retired, loved Smithsonian tours. And they were planning to go on one to Thailand and Burma. And reading all, that being good academics, they read all the literature ahead of time, of course. My mother was a high school librarian and high school English teacher. And they said, this is all about Buddhism. Our daughter's a Buddhist. We'll invite her to go with us. And they did. Mm. So totally. Toured all of Thailand and Burma.
And did you go with Larry? Did Larry go?
No, he stayed home with the kids.
Oh, and you got to go with your parents.
Yes. And one of our Tibetan Buddhist Sangha members had been a monk in one of the monasteries, what they call wats in Thailand. So from him, I got the information about that place. And after my parents flew back to the U.S., I stayed for another week in that wat. I got on, somebody at the Buddhist Association in Bangkok told me how to get there, and I took a train out to Nanachat, mm-hmm. which is a town out to the east with this wonderful monastery. It was in a haunted forest, and because the forest was haunted, it hadn't been turned into agricultural land as everything else was, and so it was there as a forest for a monastery, and it was a wat. It was especially designed for foreigners. The language of instruction was English, because most everybody around the world, they weren't just mm-hmm. people from U.S. and other English-speaking places that were from all over. It was very strict. Men and women did not even converse, let alone touch. Mm-hmm. There was a guest house. There were what cuties, little elevated huts for the monks and nuns.
Mm-hmm. How would you spell that?
Probably K-U-T-I, I would imagine. Mm-hmm. And a big salal. A meeting hall for everybody, and then a men's guest house and a women's guest house and a kitchen. And, of course, Buddhist monks and nuns don't eat after noon, so there's one meal. And villagers brought food, which all of us prepared together in the kitchen, and then that was served in the one meal. It just happened that I was there for one of the holiest days of Thai Buddhism, when everybody from the village came all night to practice. I left the next day with the chants just ringing in my head. It's a fun old woman who was just really there, really there. Practice and traveling around the paths through the forest. And Thai people, they just love aesthetics. There's nothing, no matter how simple, that isn't aesthetic. Nothing. Even like a beggar's costume, he makes sure that it looks good. And the simplest bus stops out in the country, which were simply boards, had beautiful little tops. Mm-hmm. So people went around the forest leaving little aesthetic offerings here and there, and then came back for more practice. And since it was a celebration, it would be good to have some food, but it was obviously not the right time. So we had chocolate, which was not made with milk, so it wasn't food. It'd be a celebratory with not breaking any vows. It was really a wonderful thing. So I came back from that. Before going to Thailand and Burma, oh my, I was so moved by the people of Burma. If there were a God, and that God had an idea what people should be, they are it. Have you ever been? No.
I've been to Thailand, but never to Burma. Yeah. It's one of the places that I dream about being able to go.
Yeah, you know how beautiful Thailand is and how friendly everyone is.
It's magical.
I went from Thailand to Japan. And in Thailand, of course, if you look confused, a dozen people will come up and look at your tray. Mm-hmm. Well, in Japan, people are a little more reserved. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until later I realized there were people who were desperate to help me, but wouldn't come up and say anything unless, and finally I learned if you ask,
then you'd have a throng of people, yes.
There's probably not any two more different cultures than Thailand and Japan, but I had a good time there too, of course, and walking over snow after coming from the tropics, February. So I came back realizing what I had not realized before, that Buddhism is alive and well in Asia. My impression from just reading had been that it was a dying religion there, and it isn't. It is very alive and very well. And that encouraged me to come and join the Buddhist temple here, despite the chicken teriyaki dinners, which had kind of kept us away for a while. Although, the first time I was helping with it, we had boxed lunches that we sold in addition to the hot meals. And when I would show people the box lunch, they were so delighted that I realized, yes, this did kill chickens, but it is nonetheless a wonderful offering for these people. And that reconciled me to that practice. A number of the ministers have said it's a little odd. and it was wonderful. The whole town loved it. We were told we had the best teriyaki chicken in any of their many Bay Area Jodo Shinshu churches. We had a secret formula, which was made in the middle of the night. Before he finally resigned, the one person who knew it taught one other. And people came from everywhere. Mm-hmm. And my husband was one of the ones who went at 4 in the morning to start the barbecue. Mm-hmm.
So it's one of the biggest fundraisers for the temple.
It was. We don't do it anymore, but it was. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And it was a bazaar. It wasn't just dinner. Have you been?
When it existed.
Yes, had children's games and cultural events. It was really fun, but we're not big enough anymore to mount something of that size. He would come at 4, and they'd get the coals going, and I guess about 6 they'd start barbecuing the chickens, and they would do the box lunch ones first, which then had to be frozen, chilled to be able to put in the box lunch. But meanwhile, the smoke went everywhere, so everyone knew that there's something delicious happening over there. That was fun. So came back in 84 and started. I've been going to the monthly study classes occasionally. I was starting going regularly to the temple, and it turned out they had a Dharma school. And so both my children were delighted because their good friend went to the Congregational Church across there, and suddenly they were able to do that too. Mm-hmm. And they have both, independently of each other, thanked us for sending them to the Dharma School. They've both said that they understand, seeing their peers and seeing themselves, that they learned a more effective approach to life than the usual U.S. approach, which I think is...
And when they say effective, what do you think they mean by that?
Interesting question. Obviously, kindness and compassion are central wisdom. Well, a little exercise that the Dharma School does, and that actually is good for adults too, is think of something like these glasses and consider everything that had to go into them being here, into their manufacture, into the transportation, into the retail, into my having remembered to bring them this morning, everything in as much detail as you possibly can. And the lesson of this is a Buddhist doctrine called interdependence, that there's no such thing as an independent entity. And knowing that really helps one to be an effective human being. So, that kind of thing.
And is your daughter with...
Are they practicing Buddhists?
No, or are they raising... Not. How is she raising her twins?
Oh, that's a very interesting question. Mm-hmm. So far, it hasn't come up as nearly as I can tell. You know, they celebrate Halloween and Easter as a bunny holiday.
Not as a cultural
holiday. Right, as a cultural holiday, yes. Her wife was raised Catholic and rejected it. Mm-hmm. The other grandmother, who is a far better grandparent than Larry and I, is still Catholic, belongs to a very very liberal congregation. As far as I know, does not object to the fact that her daughter left the church and really did leave, really. Mm-hmm. Is not interested in. In fact, you know, religious studies is my field. I would love to talk with her about it. And Tara's told me don't. It's not a subject that she wants to discuss. So there we are. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what disenchanted her from it. I don't know. Mm-hmm. All I know is that's her background. They have both occasionally come to my talks when I'm giving a talk here.
And what are the subjects usually when you're doing your talks? And are they always at the Buddhist temple?
The temple, yeah. Although I've given a couple through the, what did you say the name of it?
The Marin Interfaith Council, M-I-C.
Through the M-I-C. And the BTM, the Buddhist temple, or in the M-I-C, given a couple for that, but basically at the temple. And I also was teaching a class in the winter for a while, which I call Buddhist Basics.
Where was that?
At the temple.
Oh, okay.
And then, what was that, Thursday evenings. Mm-hmm. The first one was historical. Developed. The next one was ideas. Mm-hmm. And the third one would have been the various schools and how people fit into them, but that was after my husband developed dementia, and so I was no longer free to do that sort of thing. I also was the leader of the meditation Tuesday evenings for several years. Even while we were most of the time in Bellingham, somebody else would come in and substitute. Mm-hmm. But when it got to where he couldn't sit still for an hour, for a while he could stay home with the radio, and then he couldn't be home alone, so another person took that over.
And would you be willing to talk about Larry now again?
Mm-hmm.
About, because I've lived in our neighborhood now, it's 13 years. Uh-huh. So I have seen you two as a couple walking around all those years, always holding hands. As an example to my children, I always say, look at how loving these people are. Mm-hmm. And tell me about Larry. You mentioned his dementia.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I have to start with my parents. Mm-hmm. My father died in 2008. Mm-hmm. My mother lived until 2011.
Mm-hmm.
And we still felt we were obligated to the house, so we were still didn't do anything other than take care of the house.
Mm-hmm.
All these things happened end of August, beginning of September, 2008, 2011, 2012. As we were planning the course, and I was actually in the kitchen looking at the calendar, planning our trip down, and I heard a thud. Went into the bathroom, and there he was on the floor, dead. I started yelling at him, breathe, breathe. I started doing chest compressions, brought him back. He opened his eyes and said, I have to breathe. I said, yes.
Right now.
He got up, went over, sat down, and we looked at each other and said, do you think this constitutes an emergency? So we got in the car, went down to the hospital, walked in to the emergency room. The person said, what happened? He said, I fainted. They said, here, sit in this wheelchair. We'll take you in right now. Put him up on the table, did every possible test. Nothing was wrong. Nothing. His heart was perfect. We now know he has a really good heart. And so they're saying he really should stay in the hospital for observation. So I'm thinking, how much does this cost? Mm-hmm. We're going back and forth. Should we? Shouldn't we? And it happened again.
In the hospital.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. At that time, he's hooked up to everything. So there's this little chart showing this perfect heartbeat and then flatline. And they say, okay, he's staying. And then, you know, they've got him back going again. And there's something called heart block. I've learned a bit about it since then. Unrelated to a heart attack. A heart attack is the heart muscle. The heart has its own tiny brain, a pacer or a pacemaker, which sends an electrical signal to beat. If something goes wrong with that, it doesn't beat, no matter how good shape it's in. That's what heart block is, when the natural pacer or pacemaker just stops. And so they determine he has to have a pacemaker. They tried, there's a temporary one they put in through the jugular, and it just didn't work. You know, it never could get it to work. And he was having more of these episodes. And so instead of putting it in at 4 in the afternoon, the permanent one, they put it in at 5 in the morning. And I went home at just not too long before that, after he'd been taken up to ICU from the emergency room. Slept a couple hours, got up and called, and the doctor said, your husband now has a pacemaker, which was a good thing, because when we saw the same man later at 4 in the afternoon, he looked exhausted, so I'm sure he did a better job at 5 in the morning than he would have at 4 in the afternoon. And we belonged to Kaiser, and through lots of vet machinations, they eventually paid for everything, and when we got down here, they said, oh, that's beautiful. It happens that Bellingham has one of the best cardiology departments. Peace Health has one of the best cardiology departments in North America, so it couldn't have happened at a better place. Mm-hmm. So that was the first insult. And he said, you know, I think I lost a few IQ points. But he was plenty smart, that he was still smarter than most people. And we went on about our lives. That May of 2013, I was up in Bellingham, giving an award in my father's name at in the psychology department. He was down here by himself and had a pretty severe stroke. He didn't tell me about it until after I got back.
Where was he?
He was at home. Mm-hmm. And what he said, now I have no idea how accurate this is. He'd been out to meet a friend at the Exploratorium, but he never showed up, so he was out in the cold waiting for him forever. And then he and his cousin, who was very sick, had a picnic, and she's not too good at sterile technique, so I got, and he went home. He said, I slept for 4 days, and when I woke up, everything looked different. Nothing looked familiar. I didn't know what that meant until I was reading an article in the New Yorker by some neurologist who had a stroke, and that's the symptom of it. So that's how I knew what it was. It wasn't until sometime later. A friend said, well, you must have known, you wouldn't have been reading the article. I said, no, one of the obligations of a Buddhist is to know everything you can about the mind, so always read anything about the mind. He held himself together for our 50th wedding anniversary celebration in June, and then obviously went into extreme mental decline.
Very quickly from then.
Yeah, very quickly. He, in fact, had been noticing it for years, and this is fairly typical of intelligent people, that the intelligent mind is so plastic that when one part is lost, the brain can simply use another part to fulfill that function. The famous example is some chess master who noticed that he could no longer predict 8 moves in advance, and had every test done, and said, you're just fine. But he noticed that, and then years later, very quickly, died of dementia. And so, you know, when he started going down, we went to the neurologist who gave him a little test, said, oh, yeah, and then bigger test. He did beautifully on it. The doctor actually called us up in the middle, late at night to say, no, you don't have dementia. You have mild cognitive impairment. don't worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
And our daughter said, why in the world didn't we sign up for long-term care insurance at that point? But mm-hmm. we didn't. We said, okay, we'll go off to Bellingham, finish our business, mm-hmm. so on. And then the next spring, 2014, we took the ferry into the San Francisco to walk to the Exploratorium to plan for Pi Day.
Mm-hmm.
And it was raining, and Larry fell and got a pretty bad concussion. So that was number three insult. Spent the night at the Kaiser Hospital in the city. They were very nice. They made a bed for me in the waiting room so that I could, because I couldn't go home. Their car mm-hmm. was in the parking lot mm-hmm. in Larkspur.
Mm-hmm.
I was kind of wanting to be there anyway, because, and you know, they could see something back here, but it didn't get bigger, so they decided mm-hmm. it was okay. Our daughter came and got us, took us back to the car, which had not been towed away.
Mm-hmm.
So those three incidents, and then over the last year, it's been going very fast, and he now goes to Senior Access, which is a, what they call it, Marin's Premier Club. They call their clients club members for memory loss.
Mm-hmm. And where is that located?
Lucas Valley.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what do you know? Because he's still physically.
Yes. And you mentioned they're holding hands.
Yes.
Fortunately, we always have.
Yes.
So he probably doesn't notice that I'm now using it to guide him instead of just walking mm-hmm. along. But he doesn't object because we've always held hands.
Yes.
So that's very nice. Yeah, it's hard. It's hard. And he keeps saying, why am I so stupid? Why am I so stupid? And early on, I'd say, it's because you have a brain disease, which was a very mm-hmm. good example. Very good. And our daughter said, well, don't tell him that. Tell him you're really smart. I said, no, he knows better than that. Mm-hmm. But now I can say, no, you're not stupid. And he'll say, well, I'll say, yes, you're not stupid. And, you know, he's stupid enough he doesn't know the difference.
Mm-hmm.
His great distress is he is a bodhisattva. He is a person who lives for others. And his whole life has been, how can I help? How can I help? And now the best way he can help is to sit still and do nothing, because anything he does is so inappropriate that it's a problem. Almost never can he do anything that's helpful. And that's horrible for him. It's just horrible. He won't, you know. So I've determined that anything that isn't terribly destructive, I'll thank him for it.
Mm-hmm.
And so things are arranged very strangely in our house. And some rooms I don't leave him in alone, because there could be problems.
Mm-hmm.
He has occasionally disappeared while I had my back turned and have had to be found. He wears a bracelet with phone numbers on it. It's hard.
Mm-hmm.
Hard, particularly for a person like him.
And can you remind him on behalf of the millions and millions and millions of people around the world who celebrate Pi Day that he continues to help and continues to give people something to look forward to? Students, it gives them meaning to something. It's just, for a lot of kids, they just see it as part of a formula that they have to memorize. But on that day, it becomes something fun and enjoyable and something that they want to know more about. So every year, he is giving millions of people something.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. And interestingly, last year at Pi Day, when he always leads the parade.
Mm-hmm.
And last year, the wonderful events coordinator who had helped us plan it the years before had done all the planning.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, he led it
mm-hmm.
next to Larry going around. And it used to be, you know, he talked, got a lot of radio interviews and all sorts of people. And this time, some young woman from Japan came to interview him, despite the fact that, you know, there were plenty of people to see that didn't happen. And she said, in Asia, we think of math as something difficult. And here you have this holiday to celebrate it. How can you do that? And he gave his stock answer to everything, which is, it's from the heart. It's everyone cooperating together, which is what he says about everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it was because that's what he believes about everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it was appropriate. And then next you said, how many digits of pi have you memorized? And we
yeah.
just sort of managed yeah. to get out of there.
Yeah.
But so that was fine. You know, this year, who knows? I mean, at the time, I later said to Tara, the last 2 years, both of our daughters and their spouses and the twins have been there, too, which has been very nice. I wonder what it'll be like next year, but
mm-hmm.
who knows what it will be like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not there yet, but obviously we'll do something.
Mm-hmm.
And Yeah, that's very good. Indeed, it does continue to give people pleasure all around the world and to help people.
It does.
Yeah. And to make math more accessible.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit about the MIC, the Marin Interfaith Council? Because not only does Mill Valley have a Buddhist temple and many Christian and Catholic churches, mm-hmm. we also have a mosque, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. which for a town of our small size, it's quite extraordinary. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me about your involvement in that?
Just as an occasional speaker. Mm-hmm. When we became involved, of one of our ministers who's no longer with us led the involvement. It's a good group, as you say. For a while, in fact, they're probably still. They have, in addition to occasional speakers, going around to places like the Redwoods, mm-hmm. Big gatherings. They had one on Buddhism, which was at our temple, when people from many, many traditions mm-hmm. came and gave little talks about their tradition. Mm-hmm. One person said, well, how can we get more involved? And our minister said, come to church. It's called Buddhist Churches of America because when it started, and it is, by the way, the oldest Dharma group in North America. It started in the 1890s. Mm. Japanese immigrants petitioned the Hongonji, the head temple in mm-hmm. Japan, to send a couple of ministers, and they did. So that was the beginning. It's called Buddhist Churches because they wanted to fit in. They wanted to be as...
That's what I've always wondered. Why mm-hmm. is it called a Buddhist Church?
Yeah, they wanted to fit in as much as possible. Mm-hmm. And the service even is somewhat similar to a Protestant Christian service. It's different. You know, we chant Buddhist things. We have mm-hmm. a Dharma talk about mm-hmm. Buddhism and so on. But we don't sit on the floor. We sit in pews. Have an order of service, somewhat, you know. So originally that was thought that of course, World War II and the internment camps. Was your mother American? Was she in one?
She was in Japan. She is first generation. Uh-huh. She was in Japan at the end of World War II.
Uh-huh. Which was pretty hard also. Mm-hmm. Starving. Mm-hmm. Yeah, starving, wondering what to do with the rest of one's mm-hmm. life. Yeah.
But what did that time period have?
Okay, Well, one of our very best members, but people talk about how it was they came to the mm-hmm. Dharma, because just being born Japanese or Japanese-American doesn't necessitate it. Correct. An engineer who was taken out of graduate school to go there said I was there, and I kept thinking, how can people be so evil? How can people be so evil? And that's what led him to study Dharma. So, at any rate, there was a drawing in, a lack of trust. You know, we did everything we could to please them, and they did this to us. You know, hard to find more loyal Americans. Hard to find anybody who is more, but, you know, referred to as the model minority, to some people's chagrin. And that just, it changed the attitude of the people in the temples. There were at the time a couple of Caucasian ministers who could come to the internment camps and did. If you've ever seen the movie Leaving Manzanar, the Quakers, they're giving mm-hmm. out lunches mm-hmm. on the way in. Not everybody was like that. Mm-hmm. One of our Caucasian members, who was a teenager at the time, he's since died, said, I knew it was happening, I knew it was wrong, and I knew I couldn't say anything. Mm. That was in Southern California. My parents in Kentucky were unaware it was happening.
Really?
Yes. Really. Mm. Mm-hmm. They really were unaware until after the war was over that it was going on. And now there's reparations for the few surviving people. And yeah, it was awful. It was mm-hmm. just awful. And one thing we're all very proud of, after 9/11, when it looked like the same thing was going to be done to Muslims, the Japanese American community, who are generally rather retiring, came out and saying, this is wrong. Don't do it. Whether it had any effect, but it was really, really good.
Mm-hmm. How many members does the Buddhist temple have now?
About 60. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've slowly gotten smaller.
At its height, what?
Oh, I don't know, but mm-hmm. several times that. Mm-hmm. Several times that. And the old people were always the heart of it. So as they have died, it's mm-hmm. just gone down. They were, you know, those old gardeners. Boy. Mm-hmm. Kawamoto's, they were wonderful. These mm-hmm. men who are only about this high and so strong, just mm-hmm. up there. You know, we had the the canopies that had to be put up. And they, of course, they had also designed all that. They knew how it was put together. And they were wonderful. Mm-hmm. They really were. And as we've had several appreciation ceremonies for them. We have... we used to have Bonenkai, end of the year party, and eventually everybody was too busy, so now we have Shinenkai, the beginning of the year party, when we can get together, and some of those have been honoring the founders, which is good. Isa Hanamoto, who recently died as a landscape architect, was one of the first Japanese Americans to live in Marin County, and it was quite difficult, even though Hanamoto Avi, who's another of our members, somebody and somebody, is here in Mill Valley Landscape Architecture Firm. To get his place out in Lucas Valley took his other partners helping him. When the building was bought, which was long before our time, the Christian churches stood up for the group, saying this would be a good thing. That's good. So times have changed.
Yes, they have.
Have changed.
So, Catherine, the third graders in Mill Valley all do a history project. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes students will listen to these oral histories to just get an idea of what things have changed and what you foresee for Mill Valley, or what your hopes are for Mill Valley. But if you were to talk to those third graders or to your second grade grandchildren about our town, what would you want to say?
That we live in the woods. That we live in the woods. Yeah, that's why we're here. Live in the woods. Also, of course, when Larry was working, it was very close to the Exploratorium. When we bought our house, we were living out in San Geronimo Valley, where our older daughter was born. And we've lived in every town in San Geronimo Valley. We were very at home there. We'd looked around, but she was, let's see, how old would she have been? Two. We came to, there was a little moving back. We were two when she moved, but we lost our place in San Geronimo when she was still a baby. But Larry was noticing that he wasn't around enough because it was such a long drive and that we really did need to be closer. So various realtors took us to places in Fairfax that were falling down, and took us to places by the railroad in San Rafael and so on. But one realtor, I walked in, and she was so busy, she just shoved the book at me and said, "Look in Fairfax." I looked in Mill Valley, and there was one. I said, "Okay, well, that's what we want to see." She says, "Well, you go and look at it first, because, you know, I'm not going to bother." So I called up and I said, "Never mind, let's make the appointment." We drove with her. She said, "Well, you've been here before. How do we get there?" I said, "No, this is our first time." We got there. The roses were in bloom. It was May. Cascading around. It was a walk up through the trees. And Larry later said, "I walk up saying, I'll take it, I'll take it." We got up to the top of the stairs. Here's this tiny house, 600 square feet our house is. The tenants who had been there for the 4 years that it was rented out knew that they had a good deal. So whenever the realtor called and to arrange to show it, they would lock the house and leave. And they had a large German Shepherd. Every door and every window had a missing pane that the dog could stick his head out and snarl at you. So we didn't get inside on that visit. We walked all around and could see everything except one corner, and we couldn't see a stairs. And it's between two rows. There's a door on the upper road and a door from the lower
road. One on Hazel and one on Rose Avenue.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And one of the houses we had looked at in Woodacre was like that and did not have an internal staircase. So we had reason to believe there might not be one in that one corner we couldn't see. But we decided we'd risk it and made a bid on the house. After it was finalized, the tenants let us in. And indeed, there was a stairway in that corner.
Oh, that's fabulous.
So it was a bit of an adventure buying our house.
Well, you brought some photographs, and I'll take photos of them, but if you can talk about them, it would be nice.
I didn't bring any photos of the house. I should have.
Oh, that would have been interesting. So we've seen this shrine, which I can describe as It's like a medallion, but I'll photograph that after we finish recording.
Yeah.
So we'll see that. But what else did you bring to show us?
Some pictures of Larry.
Okay.
This is one of the pie parades in the New Exploratory.
Oh, fantastic. So Catherine is showing me a magazine called Dimensions from March, April 2015 with Larry leading a parade of children.
Each one is let's get in front of the microphone.
Oh, yes.
Each one is carrying a yardstick or meter stick with a pie plate on top with one of the digits of pi. And these are handed out very carefully so that no matter how many people are in the parade, it is in the correct order.
Accurate, mm-hmm. Okay.
He has a banner with Albert Einstein's picture and a boombox playing the digits of pi to Pomp and Circumstance. And then there's 3.1415 on back behind him.
That is fantastic. So I'm going to photograph that. And then it looks like you have another magazine that you're going to show me as well. Take a picture of the shrine also while it's here, because that's so important to photograph. And Catherine, if you wouldn't mind putting your hand next to it so we can see size-wise how big this item is. Fantastic. Okay.
Interestingly, this was presented to him at the last Pi Day. Half a year ago, when they moved to the New Exploratorium, they had a ceremony of digging this up.
It was, so it was in it was tiled.
It was in the center of the circular
building,
the top of the circular building, classroom, and it was very well attached, of course.
Yes.
So they had a ceremony of digging it up and taking it to the new place, but they made a new one
And so where is that located in the new?
It's outdoors.
Oh, okay.
The next Pi Day, there was a little hiatus between when the old one closed in January and the new one opened in May.
Oh.
And, of course, Pi Day occurs in March.
Right.
So the first Pi Day in the new museum, the museum was not open. Which was interesting. So we did it all outdoors and told people where the nearest restrooms were. And the then director gave a little speech about how amazing it was that we put this on in the midst of the move.
Oh, my gosh.
But since then, they've had indoors and big presentations of everything about pie and so on in the theater and the new museum. And then the walk now is outdoors. If it ever rains, we don't know what we'll do. Now, let's see, what year would it have been? Yeah, 15. Last year was a very special year because the year was 1-5.
Mm-hmm.
So it was 1.1415 for the month, the day, and the year. Then at 9:26 in the morning, the first 53 people to get there had a special pie ceremony at the pie shrine. And then they were invited in to the museum, which was not yet open since it was too early, to be served pie by the board of directors.
Oh, that's fabulous. Yes. So at Mill Valley Middle School last year, on March 14th, 2015, at 9:26 a.m., they sounded the alarm that it was Pi Day.
Wonderful.
Yes.
That is wonderful.
Yes.
Yeah.
So let me see this magazine now. So this is Micro Times from January 24th, 1994. And Larry is gracing the cover of this magazine. And Catherine, tell me about this magazine.
Okay, this was an interview with him. Here is the interview.
Okay.
And this is him. Each of these pictures are with an exhibit.
Okay, and these are exploratorium exhibits.
Yeah, yeah.
And Catherine, if you can look up as well with that. That's fantastic. Okay, tell me about this article.
Okay, I will leave it with you. We of course, have many copies.
And this as well, or you only have this?
That one, Actually, if you will take good care of your... By the way, there's no article with this.
It's just the cover.
It's just the cover. If this, on the inside, this, there's a little...
So if this is something that you'd like the history room to have, it will always live here.
My thought, which I haven't done because I no longer have free time, was to cut this out and put it here and frame that together. Well, but I've never done it, so I think if it's happy in the history room, that's a much better place for it than our house.
Okay, I will leave this with the librarians then for them to do something special with. And this, you have many.
Yes, yeah, so that one, you can do as you please.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you very much for bringing that.
Oh, yes.
Is there anything else before we conclude our interview?
Yes. The next is pictures of one of our re-weddings.
Oh.
Actually, also, I brought some of Larry's art.
Oh, we would love to see
them. Okay, he did a series based on the Hokusai views of Mount Fuji, of Mount Tam.
How did he do these?
Computer manipulation of photographs that he took. So it's Mount Tam from many, many different places.
Have you thought about digitizing these?
Oh, of course, they're on the computer.
Yeah, but you have, so you have that as well.
Probably. I'm afraid all that sort of stuff, since he... When this was his part of our lives, I knew nothing about it. And I occasionally asked him, am I being too demanding by having you be the only computer person in the family? And he'd always say, oh, no, I'm glad to do it. So consequently, once he could no longer do it, I do email and I do Google, and that's about it. So I'm sure we have this in the computer. I would have no idea how to get to it.
Okay.
He did so much art that we have several... independent hard drives of his art.
So we are looking at a photo album filled with digital manipulations of views of Mount Tam. Oh my gosh, Catherine, these are just
extraordinary.
They're extraordinary.
Yeah, they're really, really wonderful. Yeah, we go every Wednesday to the noon concert at the Throckmorton Theater. And one time they were getting ready for something about Mount Tam, and I brought this along, thought maybe, and she said, oh, that room is empty, you know, you don't even have to enlarge them, just put them in a nice mat, and we can put them up, but you need to do it right now. And one of the things he and I used to do together was mount art shows, but I realized I couldn't do it. I actually started to cry. And she advised us to get them out of this and get them into proper archival.
Yes.
Right. Yes. He does have some bigger ones out of Mount Tam, but of other things which are in proper archival space. And then in addition to that, he's done a lot of abstracts, which are based on photographs that he took.
Wow.
Some of, let's see, which way did they go? This way. Yeah. Yeah, some of these have been made large. And then some of them are... not moved around, but just colorized in different ways. He's had one art show. This one he made huge, and it was there.
So for someone of his generation, being involved in digital photography and computer-generated art is unusual, wouldn't you say?
No, that and he's... it was unusual for anybody when he was doing these.
How did he get involved in...
Well, we've always loved photography.
But in terms of
and he's always loved computers. Actually, I didn't know he loved computers till he retired. This one goes this way, and this one goes this way. This is a sculpture of the Western Washington University of Bellingham, a Noguchi sculpture.
Oh, Isamu Noguchi.
Yes, yes. And here is the invitation to his one art show and his 70th birthday.
Oh, combined. If we can hold that up.
I can also take it out of there if it's too shiny.
No, nope, that's great, just like that.
Oh, I can give you one of these. We've got lots of them. Okay.
Put that one.
Ah, and here he is with a couple of them big.
Oh, that's fantastic. So, Catherine, if you can hold that up again, that's great. Okay.
And I think that's the end. Yeah, other things. So, that's... that's another of his careers. He also, as as a retired person, worked as an audio engineer for Dharma groups. He would record a Dharma lesson, even like whole retreats worth of Dharma lessons, and then go through it. And there's a program on the computer where it acts as an oscilloscope.
Mm-hmm.
So he would run the whole thing through, look at it on that. Every time there was a or something like that, take it out, or the, you know, somebody hitting mm-hmm. something. And so it would come out as this beautiful talk that anybody could listen to. In addition to doing it for Dharma groups, we were involved in Arlene Bloom's attempts to get the toxins out of our furniture, the fire retardant dilemma. She gave a series of seminars where she would invite, she's a chemist, mm-hmm. Very famous chemist. Also, she led the first women's expedition of Annapurna. Very fine person, a reedy. And I'm not sure how we even knew about this, but he purchased a whole good set of microphones and amplifiers and so on. And so initially there were three a year and then two a year and then one a year, and he both recorded and had the speakers, the amplification for mm-hmm. for those seminars for years. And finally now California law has changed, so it's no longer required that we have toxins in our furniture, mm-hmm. as you know.
Yes.
So that was his volunteer career in retirement,
mm-hmm.
one of them, in the photography as an artist.
So, Catherine, as we wind down with our interview, it's very probable that your daughters will read these transcripts or listen mm-hmm. to this, mm-hmm. and then your grandchildren as well. Mm-hmm. What would you like them to know about you and Larry, just so that they know about your history or your thoughts as we end this interview?
Mm-hmm. Let me show you one more thing.
Okay.
This is a photo album of our third re-wedding at Kirby Cove. Here we are getting ready.
So this would be, your 21st, if it was every 7 years or
so. More than that. Interestingly, this other couple, two other couples at that point, a good friend of ours, were married 7 years after our wedding.
Mm.
So 7 years after that, we had a re-wedding with them.
Oh, so if it was your third, then your first would have been your seventh anniversary, 28th.
Yes.
Then. Okay.
Yes. And then some good friends of theirs were married 7 years after that, so that added a third couple. And the first, our wedding, as I said, was on the slopes of Mount Diablo.
Mm-hmm.
The first re-wedding was in Lagunitas. We had friends that had a lovely house there, and we just went out to a hillside and had the ceremony mm-hmm. there. And then the next two were at Kirby Cove, and this is the second one at Kirby Cove.
In 1984,
it says. Right, and have three couples, mm-hmm. and the children are involved. We had, by that time, each of the first two couples had two children,
mm-hmm.
Tara and Sarah and Jeff and Ethan. And we spent the night in Kirby Cove. This is mostly getting ready because, this is the actual ceremony here.
And so what did the ceremonies involve?
Dancing. I always gave a little talk about how this is a turning of the wheel
mm-hmm.
and a renewal and leaving behind what one wants to leave behind and continuing what one wants to continue and gathering what new one should. It's getting dark now. And then the next day took some pictures of the tents. And the reason it was only twice at Kirby Cove was because they changed their rules, so it made it very hard for us to reserve the place.
Oh, to have that for your group.
Yes. And so, fortunately, the other couple, the second couple, have had in the meantime bought a large and beautiful house in Los Gatos.
I'm going to go back to this one. There's one picture, either in this one, of the two of you there, these two.
It's a little dark by then.
If you can hold that up again like that, we'll get the glare. These are fantastic, Catherine. Thank you so much for bringing all of this.
And the last one, this had seven couples.
Wow. And where was the last one? Was that in Lagunitas?
At Los Gatos.
Oh, at Los Gatos.
The last three have been in Los Gatos at our friend's house. There we are. At the time, we thought it was important that men and women be differentiated, so the men got to wear like collars of flowers, and the women
got a headpiece.
Yeah, now both sexes wear garlands of flowers on their heads. Mm-hmm. But at the time, the men had these kind of yoke things.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, that's fantastic. Well, Thank you so much for sharing your memories and your time with us. Is there any last thing you would like to say?
Okay. I ended up talking more about my family than about Mill Valley.
That's okay.
Until I read the little thing this morning, I'd assumed it would all be about Mill Valley.
No. Because your family and you are also part of Mill Valley. Mm-hmm. So it is part of Mill Valley, but not just about the physical community, mm-hmm. but about you as an individual within that community and your family within that community. Mm-hmm. So it is about Mill Valley, but perhaps in a different way than you anticipated.
Yes. And it was a wonderful place to raise children because they could be free. I didn't have to accompany them when they went places because we were in the woods. Mm-hmm. And the woods is a good place for children.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the children appreciate that as well as having been raised appreciate being raised Buddhists.
Yes.
Yeah. So thank you. This is very interesting.
Yes. Well, thank you very much. I'll turn this off.